Thank you for watching the Gross After Abuse YouTube channel. If you enjoyed this video, please share it with other people. The video outline is as follows. I will be discussing the book key points and my opinions and the summary I got from all of the books overall and my readings. I read more books about disordered people than the ones included in this list, so I might have omitted some really good books. Sometimes the book is useful even if I disagree with some aspects of it. And overall, the information got repetitive, so I made some book reviews shorter. Books on Narcissism. 1. Traumatic Narcissism, Relational Systems of Subjugation by Daniel Shaw, and he is a licensed clinical social worker. Shaw is a psychotherapist, and this book was expensive, so I rented it out on Kindle, and it was a really good book because he's one of the few authors that talk about pathological malignant narcissists, because other therapists who write books on the subject matter of narcissism omit this. He states that traumatizing narcissists are those who have been abused as children and react to the abuse by striving for fantasies of omnipotence and power. They try to kill their vulnerabilities. So as an adult, they need to control and exploit others. He explained narcissism as a system of relational subjugation that occurs within interpersonal relationships, cults, and in society. There are a lot of parallels between growing up in a dysfunctional family and growing up in a cult. He says, quote, "The narcissist seeks hegemony for his subjectivity by weakening and suppressing the subjectivity of the other for the purpose of control and exploitation. The other is then left in grave doubt about the validity and even reality of their own subjectivity. This sadistic and abusive aspect of narcissism stems from the belief, often held unconsciously, that the separate subjectivity of the other is a threat to the survival, literally and figuratively, of one's own subjectivity, and therefore, the other must be captured and kept under control." I interpreted this to mean that the narcissist has to control your version of reality, and when they can't do that, they feel threatened. So that implies you have no right to your opinion, and you have no right to be a separate autonomous human being. You are their slave. That means if you have your own opinion, that's a threat to them. Instead of having a mutually reciprocal relationship, the narcissist needs to impose power and control dynamic on the victim. They have to brainwash them, humiliate them, constantly counter their perceptions of reality in order to dominate them and turn them into a useful object. The abuser systematically dehumanizes the victim within the context of an attachment relationship, and then the victim has to start denying their own needs, wants, feelings, and perceptions of reality, or the narcissist will punish them. And so they have to agree with the abuser's version of events and then become enslaved in a tyrannical relationship. For me, I think it's a process of conditioning and punishment. And so the narcissist will reward you if you obey and you agree with their reality. They will punish you if you try to be separate at all. You have a separate opinion, you believe reality is different from what they say. That's almost like total control. This abusive process is often intergenerational, meaning abuse can be carried down from parent to child. I would recommend this book if you were abused by a malignant narcissist or pathological narcissist, or are interested in dark triad personalities, or the connection between narcissism and cults. 2. Understanding and Treating Pathological Narcissism by John S. Odronizuk, PhD. This author has over 100 scientific publications, authored 3 books with the American Psychological Association, and is a professor of the University of Columbia and won many awards for his career contributions. This book was expensive, and it's more academic, and it's probably aimed at clinicians and researchers rather than people looking for advice on their abusive relationship. However, it's informative in summarizing the historical literature on narcissism, the academic version written by researchers, providing a detailed diagnosis and assessment, and then exploring the more recent approaches in treating pathological narcissism. I think the author did a good job summarizing the differences between covert and overt, but the most important thing for me is that he states as of now, the evidence for treatment for narcissism is still based on theory, unsubstantiated theory, meaning there's no necessarily real-world data that confirms any treatment will work. That means if you ever encountered a licensed therapist with a PhD, a PsyD, an MD, or a master's degree of any kind who states that they can treat narcissists, their method isn't proven yet. So they are just having a subjective opinion. It's based on theory. They kind of formulate a hypothesis and they think that they can treat a narcissist, so it's not definitively proven. I do believe they can probably do some short-term behavioral modifications, because I think right now, pathological narcissism cannot be cured. A lot of therapists see a jerk and call that a narcissist, so they're using a terminology incorrectly, and they're identifying the person incorrectly. And so they may say that they can change that person who is self-absorbed and selfish, but that person isn't a narcissist, so that person is capable of self-reflection. Anyways, I also interpret this author's work to mean go really low contact if you're dealing with a malignant narcissist, because they're really relationally dangerous, and there's no evidence they can change. He states that malignant narcissists, quote, present with a grossly unstable, distorted sense of self and others, extremely disturbed relationships marked by frank exploitation and sadism. They are aggressive and they need you to feel defeated. They have a hard time with reality and truly believe, because I want or need or believe it to be so, it is. So I think his work validates the online YouTube community, because many of these victims were exposed to malignant narcissists. And even many therapists who say that they understand narcissism, which is a minority of therapists, by the way, these ones don't even acknowledge the existence and dangers of the malignant ones. Perhaps because they've never personally suffered at the hands of one of these scary types. They think that malignant narcissists are just mild narcissists and give horrible advice to patients. It's scary how some therapists who say they understand narcissism do not get it. And so I think it's a warning to be very careful with the therapist, because look, if they never personally suffered with a narcissist and they see them in the session or they hear you talking about them, it's really hard for them to understand the level of sadism and intentionality and awareness and lack of empathy and just complex manipulation schemes and maybe 100 procedural steps to conduct a smear campaign against you. I had this done to me, and I have a hard time even understanding this, because that's just not in my belief system of what human beings are capable of. But I had to change that because I saw it in action. 3. Sweet Relief from the Narcissist by Melissa Schechner and Tina Moody. One has an MBA from MIT, another is a therapist with over 30 years of clinical practice. I did a more detailed book review of this on my channel. Overall, I think they did a good job describing what it feels like to go through a toxic relationship with a narcissist, and they use simple language instead of jargon to label the experience so that victims can get a sense of what happened to them. However, their description is limited to overt narcissists, whereas the covert narcissist traits can manifest differently. And I think a lot of researchers talked about that, where some of them are describing overt narcissists and some are describing like vulnerable, depressed narcissists, where like they're highly sensitive, they play the victim, they're constantly butthurt over everything. They are entitled and they have no empathy for you still. So it's good that in their book, these people have a no contact option, because that is one possibility that you need to take with your narcissist. One thing that they could have included is kind of emphasizing the huge cost of staying, because in my personal opinion, if you have a narcissist as a romantic partner, I think it's better to leave instead of being metaphorically and emotionally cut every single day. It's kind of like you're kind of a caged animal in this power and control relationship, and you could do so much better, but you might not know what the alternative is, because maybe you've only had relationships with narcissists. Some of the characteristics of narcissists include being charming, rushing intimacy, loving phrase, vibrant performances socially, talking about oneself excessively, pursuing their wants regardless of the consequences, getting angry when you have upset feelings, forgetting important stuff about you, insincere apologies, or none at all. In the book, they talk about idealization and devaluation, so how you don't exist, learning what triggers you, reclaiming your focus toward yourself, and then setting boundaries based on your needs and focusing on you. The narc relationship characteristics is the only reality is the narc's reality. They have poor listening and questioning skills. They're unreliable. They have broken agreements. They're always right, blameless, superiority or disrespect, victim mentality, meaning they feel like they're always being mistreated. And my opinion on this is that it stems from entitlement thinking, so they're not actually being mistreated by anyone, they just keep saying that they are. They're emotionally unaware. The emotionally learning is not internalized, so the same problems keep coming up, and they keep upsetting you in the same ways. Others need to take care of their emotions. They can't identify their own emotions. They actually are skilled people pleasers when they want supply, which is interesting. So that's how they kind of transform into your soulmate when they want to ensnare you in a relationship. Constantly resents you. Simplistic worldview. I see that where they have black and white thinking. The actions don't match their words. They have a simulation of emotions. So you think that they're feeling these emotions, but they don't. And I see narcissists, they go to being super enraged to just being calm, like within seconds. And I don't think a normal human being can do that. I can't do that. Inability to love. Positive attention for them is mandatory. They never get enough from you no matter what, so you're never good enough. Their image matters above all else. Self-promotion and performance may appear to be an extrovert, and a lot of their criticism is imagined. And this is where they kind of get super triggered over nothing and butthurt. So that also could be like a covert narcissist. It depends on the situation. 4. H.G. Tudor books. So I read over 7 of his ebooks, including Fuel, No Contact, and more. Evil, Manipulated. H.G. Tudor is a self-proclaimed narcissist. His books were useful in understanding a narcissist's innermost thoughts, including the motivations and reasoning process. I spent thousands of hours listening to my narcissistic mother and brother give monologues about stuff, and their moral reasoning is very similar to the way that H.G. Tudor thinks, which is eerie. He reveals the mind of a predator, and he answered, to me, is a narcissist intentional and can they change? Dr. George Simon said they're aware, and H.G. says that narcissists are aware to some extent that they are hurting you, and they don't care because they don't have emotional empathy for you. If the narcissist is pathological, most likely they cannot change. And he talks about different classifications of narcissists, which were useful. And one of the most important concepts that I got from his book is that narcissists are addicted to supply, whether it's negative or positive. Positive supply is admiration, which is love, attention, gifts, positive feedback, whereas negative supply is when the narcissist elicits negative emotions from you because it makes them feel superior and powerful, and they like negative supply more. Hence the sadism aspect that many therapists who study narcissism even fail to acknowledge. What I learned is that pathological narcissists don't have the same emotional infrastructure as people with a conscience who can feel love, connection, and empathy. 5. Character Disturbance by Dr. George Simon, PhD, and he has decades of experience studying disordered people. He states that disordered people's conscience is underdeveloped and impaired. He is fully conscious of his problem behaviors. He not only exactly knows what he's doing, but he's also fully aware of his motivations for doing it. Disordered people often pathologically lie. They can do it automatically because of this habit. And they are aware and they don't care because it comes so easily to them. He provides a lot of traits and thinking patterns of these people, and I did a video book review on this. In Sheep's Clothing, his other book, Dr. Simon talks about overt and covert aggressive personality types, and the covert ones can seek power over you by cunning, subtle, underhanded ways, like the guilt trip, which is an emotional and psychological coercion tactic. He states many different manipulation tactics, such as minimization, selective attention, rationalization, evasion, shaming, playing the victim, and more. To protect yourself, you must believe in the existence of predators, accept no excuses for bad behavior, judge actions and not intentions, set boundaries, confront with directness, and avoid making threats. I don't know about the confrontation part, because that backfired on me a lot of times and almost every time that I used it. But overall, I think his books are supremely important because he explains why the psychological field fails to help abuse victims, because the majority of mental health professionals have a false belief of human nature, and that's because the traditional paradigm of psychology that people learn in undergraduate and graduate school is based on the psychodynamic assumption that neurosis is the root of all problems. So if somebody is acting badly, oh, maybe it can be fixed because they're just neurotic. And so that's false. And that explains why many therapists will minimize and deny your abusive experience because they believed in faulty things because they were taught this from their curriculum. And that's why bad ideas seem to persist even if they're disproven by so many victims' experiences. Professor and clinical psychologist Jordan Peterson espouses the idea that some people are just plain malevolent and evil because the dark side of human nature has no rock bottom. It goes straight to hell, and it can be completely horrifying, and some people can't recover from this or they're having a hard time with it. Dr. Simon highlighted that these character-disturbed personalities are aware that they hurt you and they don't care. So there are arguments that narcissists aren't aware and they can't help it and they don't mean it, and I don't think that's true because they have choices in who they select as targets and when to abuse you in private and when to abuse you in public, among other things. So there is a degree of awareness in that. However, I think there are some more low-functioning predators and higher-functioning ones, and the impulse control may be different. So based on the writings of some incompetent psychologists on narcissism, I used to believe that narcissists couldn't help it, that they weren't aware. Maybe they were just reactionary, and I could have a relationship with them. I have to just feel extremely sorry for them, right? Well, that kind of thinking led me to have excessive compassion for them, and I don't really know if they're suffering because they don't have the same emotional infrastructure as me. I don't know to understand their limited emotional spectrum because they can't feel joy, love, and connection and remorse and guilt. So how would they have a hard time? They're not like me. They're different, and I can't be projecting my human qualities on them and my emotional spectrum on them because it's not the same. And I wanted to hold on to that false hope because I wanted to believe that I could change my family. But those were false beliefs, and it was extremely harmful because the malignant narcissist just escalated the abuse over time, as they do, and they sabotaged my career plans and romantic relationship and plotted a long-term smear campaign against me. They set no-win scenarios and double blinds, and my physical and mental health just worsened. Had I swallowed the red pill earlier and accepted the brutal truth and just left, I would have spared myself thousands of hours of unnecessary emotional pain and abuse, and would have felt less panic, rage, loneliness. Thank you for watching the Growth After Abuse channel. 7. Psychopath Free by Jackson McKenzie. McKenzie suffered through a romantic relationship with a female psychopath and wrote these books as a guide to help other victims identify abusive relationships and get out and heal. And he lists the psychopathic manipulation tactics and information about recovery and grief. I have a video on this book. Some red flags he mentions are pathological lying, pity ploys, circular conversations, word salad, gaslighting, and more. Overall, I thought this book was helpful because it is from a victim who states how a psychopath behaves within the context of a romantic relationship. Whereas, some therapy books are just more abstract and theoretical, and they're detached because the psychotherapist is writing the book and they have never suffered personally at the hands of a psychopath or a narcissist. And so, even if their advice is useful, there is a limit to theoretical knowledge. So Mackenzie helps with a different layer of understanding because he gives you concrete examples from personal experiences. So it's a helpful book for victims. 8. Without Conscience and Snakes in Suits by Dr. Robert Hare. And he has a PhD, and he spent decades studying psychopathy and is a worldwide expert on this subject matter. In Without Conscience, Dr. Robert Hare studies prison populations and notices a pattern in psychopaths and creates a checklist and formal scoring manual to determine psychopathy, including charm, need for stimulation, lack of remorse, acting impulsively, and more. I think this book helped highlight that the minority of prison population are filled with psychopaths, and these people are incurable, and they are not able to be rehabilitated because as of right now, there's no cure for psychopathy. They have no emotional empathy and no real remorse. He states that psychopaths are aware of how they harm others and they don't care. So this book relies heavily on prison populations. And so his checklist here, I think, has excessive criminal criteria. But his later book includes a different variety of psychopaths. In Snakes and Suits, Dr. Hare states how psychopaths often rise to high levels of the corporate ladder through manipulation. And while they're invisible to the majority of coworkers, they are nonetheless extremely harmful. There are several case studies in the book, and I have a video review of this book too. From this book, I realized that a lot of people like this were contributing to a lot of the world's problems. And so if you think about all of the awful things in the world, there's probably a cluster B personality behind it. And there's a high percentage of psychopaths as the leaders of industry and in political positions of power. 9. The Sociopath Next Door by Dr. Martha Stout, PhD. Dr. Stout provides different case examples of sociopaths that blend in with society. They are at all levels of the socioeconomic stratus, and they don't have a typical profile. Some of her examples include a middle-aged underemployed couch potato being a parasite to his parents, or another psychopath could be a female psychologist, and more. She states that sociopaths don't have a conscience, meaning they have absolutely no obligation to other people, another living creature, and humanity as a whole. They are about 4% of the population, and they're different from narcissists because they often fail to react to other people's feelings. She provides 12 rules, like go with your gut feeling, suspect flattery, and believe in the existence of predators. I did a book review on this book. Her book helped me understand that predators are unique. They have different motivations, interests, and values. So it's important not to just form false stereotypes and overgeneralizations because you could get tricked by one. Her book is important because it shatters the preconceived and traditional notions of what a stereotypical psychopath is. In fact, there is no model, and you need to be vigilant. So if you are dealing with someone who lacks emotional empathy, get away from them because they can be your coworker, boss, neighbor, prom queen, friend, or parent. 10. Coercive Control by Lisa Fontes, PhD, and she has over 25 years of experience in child abuse and violence against women. This book is pretty good, and it describes abusive relationships in plain language, but uses another concept called coercive control, which is invisible, and it strips away the victim's independence, self, and basic rights, such as the right to make decisions about their own time, friends, and appearance. There is a spectrum to this control, and she states that relationships become problematic when one person's fulfillment is routinely sacrificed in the service of another through criticism, shame, punishments, fear, and threats. The victim is increasingly adopting the abuser's worldview as their own. They're losing their sense of self as a separate person. Shaw independently said that narcissism is all about power and control, and Dr. Simon says that disordered people only care about what they want. In this book, Fontes explains the different methods of control and gives good advice on how to end the relationship and help others. 11. Betrayal Bonds by Patrick Carnes, PhD. International Authority on Addiction and Recovery Issues. I think this is a great book, and it describes a trauma bond with the abuser and provides a lot of great information for recovery. So he explains in a clear way why people become obsessed and addicted to toxic relationship, because there is a shared highs and lows. And so I think if you have a high, you can have a withdrawal from that high and become addicted. And remember, narcissists manufacture highs. They are faking it. A lot of them become your fake soulmate. And we previously learned that if they want to get narcissistic supplied, they act on their best behavior. They will transform to the person you want for that supply, get you attached, and then start abusing you. He defines a betrayal bond as a breach of trust and continual exploitation from someone you have an attachment relationship with, but you are loyal to someone who is destructive to you. And he lists 14 indicators of this, like false promises, degrading acts, and more. He states that over time, little acts of degradation, manipulation, and secrecy take a traumatic toll. And he explains why an abusive relationship is really dangerous to your health and how betrayal bonds are made stronger when there is high intensity, terror, confusion about love, and more. The starting point for trauma is a complete acceptance of betrayal. And I call that swallowing the red pill. Or for a pathological narcissist or psychopath, realizing that they love to use you like an object, but they are incapable of loving you as a separate human being. Carnes lays out the path of awareness, action, and recovery, like no to limited contact. A person can be continually betrayed by selecting bad relationships, like a life pattern, and they can forever be in trauma bonds, but these can be disruptive when new healthy bonds are available. So I guess if you have alternatives, then you can escape your trauma bonds if you have more awareness and realization of what's going on. 12. Books from Dr. Linda Martinez Louie, and she has a PhD in clinical psychology. The first one is Freeing Yourself from the Narcissist in Your Life. This book is all right. And the author talks about how the narcissist creates a fake mask and talks about the different roles, like the golden child and the scapegoat. She details the examples of well-known people like Picasso, Ayn Rand, and Frank Lloyd Wright, and describes the traits of narcissism. The other book, Recovering and Healing from the Narcissist, it's an okay book, and it provides advice from people who are individuating from the narcissist, and how to transform yourself and install good habits like implementing a daily writing practice and doing calming exercises. I like her YouTube channel, and I think she is one of the few people that talk about how dangerous narcissists can really be. The Narcissist You Know by Joseph Burgo, PhD, Clinical Psychology. So this book is a good book about narcissism. I like how the author talks about how the word narcissist has become diluted to mean a jerk when the word should have a more serious connotation. And he coins a new term called the extreme narcissist, which makes up 5% of people, and they're highly dangerous. So right now, I think in public, it's normal to call someone a narcissist as an insult. And so the majority of people are going to take that term to mean a selfish or self-absorbed person, kind of a jerk, and they don't really understand the extreme connotation that the real diagnosis underlies, which is someone who is extremely manipulative, lacks empathy, sets up complex manipulation schemes, is completely exploitative, and has elements of sadism. I think that's what the term would mean, but most people, first of all, will not believe that exists and is not using that word correctly. So this author coins that term, extreme narcissist, and he supports the idea of a narcissistic spectrum or continuum. And so I guess there's people with traits of and people who are pathological. And he talks about the different types, like the bullying narcissist, grandiose one, there's a know-it-all one, self-righteous one, extremely controlling one. Even though this book was interesting, a person who needs immediate help in an abusive relationship could read other books like Betrayal Fawns instead, because that this one talks about narcissism in society more. Burgo says that with an extreme narcissist, there is rarely an upside to engaging. He says that when it comes to romantic involvements with an extreme narcissist, your best course of action is to avoid them in the first place, or to disengage once you realize their true nature. Don't go into a relationship with a narcissist thinking you are going to change that person, or that he or she will change because of feelings for you. 13. Carol Bride, PhD, licensed marriage and family therapist. The book, Will I Ever Be Good Enough? This book was okay, but she doesn't talk about the extreme cases, which is what I went through. So it's helpful for people and validating for daughters of mean mothers to let go of expectations of getting your mother to love you, because your mean mother may be incapable of that. And so it's important to grieve the loss and psychologically separate. Your mother's perception of you is incorrect if she's screwed up. And that's sad because she can't see you for who you truly are, and she cannot properly give you emotional support you need, and it's up to you to develop your internal caring mother for yourself. Depending on where your mother is on the spectrum, she outlines different strategies to deal with your mother, like maybe just having a superficial civil connection, or a temporary separation, or setting boundaries, or taking her to therapy. Remember, that won't work with a malignant pathological narcissist. So, I can see how there is different types of mothers, like maybe your mother might not have a cluster B personality, but she has some childhood issues, and or she might just emotionally neglect you, or she's just overwhelmed, and so she can't be there for you. So I think it's validating for daughters of those types of mothers. There's not much information on malignant narcissistic mothers in this book, and these are a different breed. They're extremely manipulative, and they lack emotional empathy. The author says that some are untreatable. So if it's up to you to determine if you want to continue contact or not. And other books help fill in this gap and imply that untreatable mothers need their daughters to be inferior, they're a little sadistic, they use their daughters like objects, there's no real love and connection, it's mostly a power and control relationship, she tries to control you like a Barbie doll or be like a puppet master in your life. What's really crazy is that it goes against nature. It's almost like an abomination, or like the mother will intentionally sabotage the daughter's personal relationships, career, health, and other activities. So in that case, the daughter probably needs to go low to no contact. The other book, Will I Ever Be Free of You, by Dr. Carol McBride. This book was better than her previous book because I think she kind of talks about pathological narcissists, where she states that they want to control everything about you. They need to control your children too. So that's dangerous. If you have children and you're thinking, hey, but I want them to have a relationship with their grandparents. Remember, if it's a pathological narcissist, there is no relationship and they may traumatize your children. The narcissist does not feel secure enough to allow each individual in the family to have his or her own self, beliefs, decisions, and separate interests. They expect all family members' lives to revolve around them, and they ignore other people's needs and desires. There's no sense of community or individuality. Their needs rule. She details how to break free, what's best for the children, and the divorce process. So this was an okay book. I think for narcissistic grandparents, I think they could be nice to the children in the beginning because the children are not trying to exert their autonomy and they're just like kind of sources of narcissistic supply. But I think when the child starts to try to individuate and say no and have boundaries, that's going to be a huge problem. And the narcissist is going to condition that child and abuse that child to not be a separate person, to just be more contorted to being an object or a source of gratification or a tool just for the narcissist. And that's pretty scary. So don't believe that there is love or connection. 14. Emotional Abusive Relationship by Beverly Engel, licensed marriage family therapist. I did a book review on this book, and the main point is emotional abuse is a serious form of abuse and is toxic. And she talks about the childhood origins, how to determine if you or your partner was abusive in this way, and the action steps to heal. So emotional abuse is non-physical behavior that is designed to control, intimidate, subjugate, demean, punish, or isolate another person through the words of degradation, humiliation, or fear. The effects are depression, lack of motivation, confusion, difficulty concentrating or making decisions, low self-esteem, feelings of failure or worthlessness, feelings of hopelessness, self-blame, self-destructiveness. Emotional abuse is like brainwashing that reduces the victim's self-confidence and sense of self-worth and trust in his or her perceptions, self-concept, and so the victim is easier to control. Emotional abuse poisons a relationship with hostility, contempt, and hatred. So, no matter how much a couple once loved each other, once emotional abuse becomes a consistent aspect of the relationship, their love is overshadowed by fear, guilt, anger, and shame. Emotional abuse entails humiliations, put-downs, minimization, negating, control, judging, criticizing, accusing, blaming, unreasonable demands or expectations, silent treatment, disapproving, dismissive, contemptuous or condescending looks, comments or behaviors, sulking and pouting, projections and false accusations, subtle threats of abandonment, an abusive attitude, entitlement, or not noticing how other people look or feel or care. I think this book is great for revealing how harmful emotional abuse is, and I just listed out a lot of the emotional abuse behavioral traits. 15. Wizard of Oz and Other Narcissists by Eleanor Payson, and she's a licensed marriage and family therapist. The other part of the book is Coping with a One-Way Relationship in Work, Love, and Family. So this book provided a metaphor of how Dorothy's journey in the story of the Wizard of Oz showcases different types of seductive encounters with a narcissist with different masks on, meaning these are people who are too good to be true in the beginning, so that's when they're charming. However, she states that narcissists will never get to accountability. They're entitled. They need to control, inflict pain on others. They actively manipulate. They create a persona that is not the true person they are in private, and they sabotage you. This book is good in describing pathological narcissists, but in my opinion gives suboptimal advice. The author states that you should just assert yourself, and that may be good advice when dealing with a jerk or a difficult person who is capable of self-reflection and only has a few traits of narcissism, but this is horrible advice for dealing with a malignant predator because they will just retaliate and they will not necessarily accept your boundaries. You have to be completely subjugated. Limited to no contact is the best strategy. And so I noticed that some of the authors, like, they describe what narcissists are, but then their advice, because I think they've never personally suffered from one, they don't know that the retaliation is extreme. They're like, oh, just set boundaries. And I was like, yeah, every time I set boundaries with a pathological narcissist, and they try to sabotage me behind my back, they escalated the abuse directly or indirectly, and so they get really vindictive and nasty. And so it depends on your narcissist. I guess if it's a jerk, like, they can handle it. But if you're dealing with an extreme pathological narcissist who needs to exert power and control and has elements of sadism, this will not work. I think there is no hope, and I'm really sorry. 16. Stop Caretaking the Borderline or Narcissist by Margalies Felsted, PhD, licensed marriage and family therapist. This book was useful in describing the emotional, behavioral, and thought distortions that a caretaker of disordered people have, and it provides some strategies to set boundaries. I think people use different terminology to mean the same things, and so from her description of a caretaker, I think that's similar to what a codependent is, or what someone in the community would call narcissistic abuse victim, or an empath without boundaries. A lot of complex post-traumatic stress disorder victims think that they are borderline because they suffer from a lot of emotional dysregulation, and they believe that they get triggered a lot and they're afraid of abandonment. But the terminology is confusing because malignant borderlines actually have a narcissistic expression, meaning they think they're the victim, but really they're the abuser, and they have impaired empathy, entitlement, and they're exploitative. And that's something that people with CPTSD don't have in high degrees of. Dr. Marsha Linehan has studied BPD and created a treatment program for them, and I read her clinical manual for dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, and I think her treatment works with people with complex trauma because these people think they have borderline, and it's because complex trauma isn't in the diagnostic statistical manual yet. And, you know, that itself is a highly bureaucratic political process. It's imperfect, and the psychological community is kind of doing a bad job with personality disorders, hence the explosion of YouTube videos and the big online community that is trying to compensate for the fact that the psychological community does not handle Cluster B personalities well, and they're not giving the right help for victims as a whole. My personal opinion on BPD is that a lot of people with complex trauma think that they have borderline, but they don't have the element of exploitation, entitlement, and impaired empathy. And so that wouldn't make them borderline, in my opinion, because the psychological community doesn't have narcissistic abuse syndrome or complex trauma. And that describes a person who just had a horrible attachment relationship with a Cluster B personality who's been repeatedly abused relationally, and so they're going to have a lot of psychological triggers and emotional dysregulation and some fears of abandonment. I think overall this book was all right, and the author does say it is up to the victim to stay or leave. There's not much information about malignant predators in this book, and I think other authors do a better job about these types of Cluster B people. But this book is very useful in detailing the habits and thinking patterns that caretakers or codependents or empaths without boundaries have and how to change those things. 17. Narcissism, Denial of the Self by Alexander Lowen, and he has an MD. This book was okay. I think there's better books out there. He states that the cause of narcissism is a lack of nurturing support and sometimes childhood abuse, like having humiliating experiences, like feeling powerless, and in reaction, they form a false self that doesn't allow for any vulnerability because this vulnerability caused them immense pain in childhood. They have low self-esteem and an inferiority complex, and they deny their own feelings and cannot sympathize with others and use others like a tool, and they try to gain power and control over them. The narcissist cannot feel emotionally fulfilled and remains unhappy. I agree with some parts. Like, I think narcissism is genetic and environmental, so somebody is predisposed to having narcissistic traits, coupled with having an environment which was invalidating, neglectful, or abusive. I don't know if the narcissist is unhappy because I can't project my emotional human experience on them. They do feel elated when they get to screw over their family and friends, and so a lot of books kind of agree with this author, but then other books would disagree, and I don't know if any of this is definitively proven. Next book, Toxic Parents by Susan Forward, and she has a PhD. I think this book was very validating in stating, hey, toxic parents exist, and some of your problems are caused by them, and I think there is a societal taboo against that. Forward describes the different types of horrible parents, and I think there are more shades of gray, as some parents did undergo trauma, and they don't have a personality disorder, but they may neglect their child, and they don't have bad intentions. I do think at the writing of this book, the author had little knowledge on psychopathy and narcissism, because she recommends confrontation without expectation. But if you are dealing with a psychopath or a malignant narcissist, they will deny, pathologically lie, blame shift, and having conversations with them is completely useless because conversations are tools to brainwash, dominate, and subjugate you. It's completely painful emotionally, and they're just going to do a bunch of emotional manipulation, like do a straw man, intentionally misunderstand you, try to elicit negative emotions, and then you're going to be really upset, and then you'll look like the bad guy because they're staying calm because they're basically mind-fucking you. This was an okay book. 19. Trapped in the Mirror by Ilan Golub, clinical psychologist. So this book wasn't written in a clear way, but the book provided a collection of patient stories who talked about the self-destructive choices they made because of childhood trauma. So it shows you how childhood trauma can affect many domains of your life. So the narcissistic parent sets you up for abusive relationships, and then they install the inner critic, and then they make the child believe that they don't have a right to exist as a separate person. It is pretty good in detailing those things, but it just doesn't describe much on how to heal. So Shaw would say that narcissistic parents are much more deliberate and intentional in how they install self-sabotage. So that can benefit the parent and hurt the child, and they don't care about that. 20 is Malignant Self-Love by Sam Vakian, and he's a self-proclaimed narcissist, and he has a PhD in another field that is not psychology. This book was very long, and it contained information that I disagreed with, and then some of it I agreed with, and he is one of the few authors in the past that acknowledged that malignant narcissists exist. But some of his positions from like his YouTube channels and books are contradictory. So overall, I think there's better books on narcissism. However, one thing I got a takeaway from this book was the different classifications. Like there is a cerebral narcissist and they feel superior by showing how smart they are. And there's like a somatic one, which means they focus on the body. And so they would get narcissistic supply by showing how hot they are. 21. Mothers Who Can't Love by Susan Ford, PhD. This book is good for daughters of narcissistic mothers, and she provides information for those mothers who have mild traits of narcissism to the extreme cases. So those are the ones that are so damaging to their daughters that they should go no contact. This is one of the few books that shows how and why some mothers are extremely destructive, whereas other books don't even want to touch on this subject because it is a societal taboo. Because in a lot of cultures, they want to uphold the myth that all mothers love their children. That's false. Some biological mothers don't love their children. If you have a sick but abusive mother, she recommends that you need boundaries because you need to prioritize yourself and notice that you matter. She says, quote, "The hallmark of these mothers is that they lack empathy. Their intense self-centeredness blinds them to the suffering that they create. They rarely step out of themselves to see things from your point of view. All they know is what they want, and they need what they need. Narcissistic mothers make us feel unloved because they are so self-absorbed with making themselves seem important, blameless, and exceptional that there is little room for anyone else. Confrontation makes them feel cornered, and when that happens, they can't and won't validate your experience or acknowledge their part in it. They rewrite reality and tell you what you didn't see, what you experienced didn't happen, and what you think is real is actually a figment of your imagination. Criticism flows from the seriously narcissistic mother anytime they feel insecure, disappointed, or deflated. Like all insecure people, they build themselves up by tearing you down. A severe narcissist is highly unlikely to admit being wrong, no matter how egregious her behavior is, and she'll say whatever she needs to make herself right. She'll lie about what she promised, lie about the behavior you witnessed, and lie about what other people have said and done." So that was from her book, and that kind of delineates how scary these mothers are. These are truly scary people. And that was my mother. 22. The Narcissistic Family, Diagnosis and Treatment by Stephanie and Robert Pressman. Stephanie is a therapist and clinical director of pediatric psychology. The main point of this book is to describe the narcissistic family model, which is the needs of the parent matters more than the needs of the child. And so the child ends up ignoring their own needs and then serving the parent. The child is not seen or heard, and their emotions or feelings are not listened to. And I guess this would be called a role reversal or parentification. There are many examples of this, such as, 1, when parents are addicted to a substance, stunted emotionally, they have a mood disorder, they have a physical disability, job stress, lack of parenting skill, or they're dealing with problems they can't handle. And so that's probably going to make the parent overwhelmed, and they can't properly emotionally or logistically take care of that child. Two, parents need the children to perform to keep a good image. Like if you have a politician as a parent who they need you to behave, or a pastor's family, they need you to act virtuous to not soil the family name, or if you have a famous family, it's like you have to kind of act in line. You can't be yourself. You have a role to fulfill. Number three, the parent could have a personality disorder. So this book doesn't talk about like extreme narcissists. I think it's more for people who come from non-disordered families with overwhelmed parents, but then these people can still have emotional scars. You don't need a cluster B parent to have childhood trauma, and you can have a lot of unmet emotional needs. It shows that even if a family appears loving on the outside and maybe upper middle class and have everything going for it, if on the inside there is a void of affection, the family can be disordered. It's like a narcissistic family unit where the children's needs are not taken care of. It's all about the parents. This book is pricey, and it's probably for clinicians. The Human Magnet Syndrome by Ross Rosenberg, the 2018 version, and he is a licensed counselor. The main point of the book is that if parents deprive you of unconditional love, especially during your early years, you may be drawn to a narcissistic partner with magnet-like force. So, due to unconscious trauma-based psychological forces, codependents and pathological narcissists are almost always attracted to each other. The resulting relationship is mostly breakup resistant, and the narcissists benefit the most from the situation. He states that codependents are stuck in a pattern of giving and sacrificing. They have low self-esteem and pessimism that manifests as a form of learned helplessness that keeps them with their narcissistic partner. Their fear of being alone, their compulsion to fix and control at any cost, and their comfort as a role of the martyr who is endlessly loving, devoted, and patient is an extension of their yearning to be loved, respected, and cared for as a child. In the new version of the book, he describes the core problem of codependency as a lack of self-love, and then he relabels this condition as self-love deficient disorder, or self-love deficit disorder. To get out of this toxic relationship cycle, he recommends learning to build self-love. So he describes a spectrum of chemistry ranging from negative to positive 5, negative 5 being a really unhealthy codependent who has little to no self-love, and they continually ignore their own needs to cater to other people. A plus 5 represents a pathological, malignant narcissist who continually takes and gives nothing to the relationship. So according to the relationship compatibility theory and opposite attraction, you have a negative 5 will be magically attracted to a positive 5 pathological narcissist. A plus 2 person, so that would be a person with traits of narcissism. So they're not like really high in the spectrum, they just have some traits of. They'll be attracted to negative 2 level self-love deficient or codependent. He states that there are exceptions to that theory, like conservative culture and other factors that influence whether the couple stays married or etc. So, like he said, I think in my opinion, there are exception cases, and in my experience, I've seen two predators in a relationship and different combinations. Like I've seen like a cerebral and somatic type narcissist, and sometimes their relationship is unstable and short-term, so it may last from a couple months to a few years, and then they just, like, break up because it's high conflict. I've seen psychopaths and narcissists, or a narcissist, a covert and an overt, or a narcissist and malignant borderline, and the relationships can be short-term and unstable, and I've seen long-term ones, and it kind of acts like a business arrangement where they're helping each other get supply. I don't have statistics, but I think in the majority of cases, it's probably a codependent or a self-love deficient person with a narcissist, and they form a stable long-term bond, which is unhealthy. Next book, The Narcissist and Borderline Couple by Joan Lochker, and she's a licensed therapist. Lochker explains that some narcissist and borderline couples stay in painful, conflictual, never-ending relationships, as a result of traumatic bonding, because each partner stirs up some developmental issue in the other. I like how she includes different variety of narcissists, ranging from malignant, depressive, and more, and she defines borderline as someone who has an attachment disorder, and they tend to subjugate and compromise themselves and question their existence. They suffer from abandonment and anxiety. They tend to merge with others and have problems with emotional regulation. I think other authors would probably say that this is an incorrect label and call that person a codependent or a self-love deficient or an empath without boundaries or a person who has narcissistic abuse syndrome or something, or someone with complex PTSD, someone with attachment trauma. I think it's different because malignant borderlines, they have impaired empathy, they're exploitative, and they're entitled, and at the core, they have narcissistic expression. So even though they act like a huge victim, and they're constantly butthurt, and their emotions are all over the place, like, at the core, they don't have emotional empathy for you. And that's important, because a lot of people with complex trauma do. Like, maybe they have a lot of psychological triggers, and they're upset, and have a lot of negative emotion, but people with complex trauma who don't have cluster B have emotional empathy. They do care about others. They're not exploitative. So based on object relations theory, her book supports the idea that attachment trauma creates an insecure attachment style that makes couples stay in unsatisfying relationships. Now I'm going to talk about some authors. So Dr. Bruce Perry is an MD, PhD, and he devoted his entire career to studying childhood trauma. I recommend his books, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, and his other book, Born for Love. And they're really important because he details how improper childhood development is very important for the formation of empathy, how environmental factors can affect the genetic predisposition toward how disordered behavior can be expressed. And so that means if you have a child with a genetic predisposition to become a cluster B personality, if you are very loving and nurturing, maybe there's a possibility to prevent that. He provides different accounts of traumatized children and how to facilitate recovery. For example, there was a case in his book where the mother left her baby crying, and she just did this to take walks with her other toddler, and I don't know if she did this a lot, but because she kind of neglected the baby enough, and maybe that baby was high needs or maybe predisposed to becoming a psychopath, that baby grew up empathy impaired. And so that necessarily isn't abusive. That's kind of, she kind of neglected that baby during critical times, and maybe she was unaware that it was like high needs or something. And so that explains a lot, where you don't necessarily have to have extremely abusive parents to have a psychopath, because I have a friend with a psychopath mother, and she seemingly had two loving parents, and she had a sister who was not a psychopath, and she was the only bad seed in the family. And I wonder if it is just genetics, because neuroscience Dr. James Fallon would say that sometimes psychopathy is strictly genetic. Or maybe, like Dr. Bruce Perry, environment matters a lot, and it doesn't necessarily have to be abuse. It could be just neglect during critical windows of childhood development. I don't know what the answer for my friend is. Maybe her mother was unintentionally preoccupied during the critical window of development as a baby, and so her unintentional neglect, coupled with her genetic predisposition, made sure that she just became a horrible psychopath. Moving on. The following authors are quoted by other therapists and researchers of personality disorders, and their books are more academic and theoretical, and they provide different ideas on how and why narcissism forms. The books are not filled with practical advice like manipulation tactics outlined in the book Psychopath Free or Sweet Relief from the Narcissist. So there is an important psychoanalyst, Otto F. Kernberg, and he's widely known on his theories on borderline and narcissistic pathology. He talks about a more extreme narcissist at the malignant or psychopathic level, and says they're unable to experience others as separate autonomous human beings. They feel paranoia, hatred, and envy of the other, and therefore have to devalue, spoil, and depreciate the other. And so he is one of the early psychoanalysts that acknowledges the existence of malignant narcissists, and he incorporates that element of sadism. And I think I grew up with a narcissistic brother and mother of this kind. So that may not describe all narcissists, because I do see a distinction between my father, who is a covert narcissist. Moving on, Heinz Kohut, as a psychoanalyst who is widely known for his development on self-psychology, he asserts that the parents need to manage the child's grandiosity, and this is important for healthy development, and failure to do so will lead to developmental arrest, in which the narcissist needs to depend on others to bolster this grandiosity. And so I think he's different in saying that the formation of the narcissistic self is a maturation step. If he's right, then another reason for narcissism is if you just take a child, and maybe you're not abusive, but you constantly tell the child that they're just better than other people, you don't set boundaries, you spoil them, you cater to their every want, and then they kind of have grandiose self where they just think they're better than other people, they're exploitative, and you don't nurture that empathy aspect. Although these two authors, Kernberg and Kohut, have differences in views, I think both of them have some validity to their theories. I don't know about the formation of a narcissistic healthy self. I mean, a lot of people say that, I don't know about that. But there is a continuum ranging from milder ones to pathological, malignant ones who have sadism. And you have different categories, like you have a vulnerable, covert narcissist, and they're shy, so they're not going to be the center of attention. They're going to be in the corner, maybe sulking, wondering why everyone isn't paying attention to them when they're not putting any effort, and they're kind of really self-absorbed, and they're in their own little world where it's all about them, and they kind of portray themselves as a nice person, and they're not. So there's different types, and then there's the extroverted, overt type, and they could be cerebral, meaning like they think they're just smarter than everyone, and they use that to get narcissistic supply, or they could be somatic, meaning they are always flaunting their body. Another author is James Masterson, and he has an MD, and he wrote many books on narcissism, and I read The Narcissistic and Borderline Disorders, an Integrated Developmental Approach, a long time ago. And it was kind of informative because it's full of theories about narcissism. It's probably not for victims who need immediate relief, and it's aimed more for researchers and clinicians. Thank you for watching the Growth After Abuse YouTube channel. What happened to me is that I visited over 10 therapists beginning from when I was 21, and I read a lot of books about psychology in general. Of the therapists that I visited, only one out of 10 or 12 understood what narcissism was. And so there was a lot of therapists who kind of minimized my experience, and they exactly fell into the stereotype of what Dr. George Simon said. They kind of don't believe in the existence of predators. And so when they think of a narcissist, they're like, oh, I get it. That's a person who's a jerk. No, these people don't get it. And they have like a master's degree, or some of them have PhDs, or they have an MD, like they could be a psychiatrist, which I went to too, and they don't get it either. And so the majority of clinicians outside don't get it. And so that was when I started reading books on narcissism. And what scared me was that some therapists with decades of experience who write books on narcissism give horrible advice because they don't understand narcissism at the extreme pathological level. And they think a malignant narcissist is just similar to a person who has some traits of selfishness and self-absorption. That is not true. I suffered more years of abuse and life sabotage because I took that advice. I had the false hope that I could change my family, that I could just go back and set boundaries and have a semblance of a relationship. I kept thinking that, oh, maybe the narcissist is reactionary. Maybe they can't help it. They don't know what they're doing. They don't have bad intentions. And I was wrong, and I suffered a lot of consequences because of it. I think the advice that a lot of therapists give about narcissists are good for if you're dealing with a jerks or a person with a few traits of narcissism, not the pathological ones. So I just wish I had a therapist tell me, like a long time ago from the beginning, maybe when I was 21, malignant pathological narcissists cannot change. There's no real love and connection, and they need a control and subjugate you and make you feel inferior. There's elements of sadism. There's no hope. Please go limited to no contact. If I was given this advice, I wouldn't have gone through so much abuse. I wouldn't have let the narcissist sabotage my relationships, career, and health and more. And now I know why the narcissism community is so big on YouTube and online. And it's because the psychological field as a whole is failing to teach therapists who have like a PhD, PsyD, master's degree, and licensed counselors about the severity of this disorder. Like, they're not talking about the extreme ones. And I told you I have like two extreme ones in my life. Maybe three if you're including, three or four if you're including friends. So because therapists who write books on narcissism, like if they've never personally suffered at the hands of a predator, they may give bad advice. They're just telling you to set boundaries and you'll be fine, or try to communicate better. And that's kind of bad advice if you're dealing with an extreme one. There's some therapists who say that narcissists are like really suffering underneath it all. And, you know, that is a theory. Other authors and therapists would disagree with that. And I kind of used to believe that at a time where I would feel like a lot of compassion and sympathy for them because I'm like, oh, they're so hurt. But that's not true necessarily, because they have a completely emotionally different infrastructure from you. Because I feel like joy and love and connection, and I feel sadness and grief and remorse. If they don't feel remorse, I don't know if they feel the depth of sadness and grief that we do, because they don't feel the love and connection. In fact, I don't know how hurt they are. I can't just project my emotional infrastructure on them. I don't know what it's like to be a predator. I'm not them. And maybe their inside is just maybe void, and then they feel elation when they get to fuck with you. I don't know. And there's a lot of people who are apologists for narcissists saying that, oh, it's so sad, they're always hurt. I think the people that are saying this are projecting their own human experience onto the narcissist without definitively knowing. I think the real answer is that the research is inconclusive and we don't know. And I don't know the extent of their emotional range, because a lot of narcissists have superficial emotions. Like, they will say that they are endlessly hurt and they will rage, and then they go back to being fine in a couple seconds. And so that emotion was superficial. It's not like the emotions that I feel, where when I feel really angry, I'm angry for a long time and it takes me time to calm down. Or if I'm really sad, I am sad. And a lot of narcissists use these emotional ploys as manipulation tactics. I know they don't feel remorse. So what I'm trying to say is that we can't really understand their emotional experience. Anyways, going back to my original point, therapists can give advice that not only discounts and puts the victim in real danger, but then they can also re-gaslight the victim into believing the abuser's false narrative that, hey, the narcissist wasn't mean on purpose. And that's not true. Dr. George Simon states that the majority of therapists have an incorrect view of human nature. And so these therapists think that, hey, everyone deep down means well, and they can be changed. And that's false. Online, victims share the scariest, most horrific stories that are so eerily similar to my own experiences. And there are YouTube channels that tell you to go limited to no contact if your predator is malignant. And that kind of helps a lot of victims get red-pilled and give them the opportunity to go no to low contact and heal and enter reciprocal relationships. So I talk about extreme narcissists in this video a lot because I grew up with two of them, and that doesn't mean that's true for your experience. I do think it is a continuum and spectrum, and so maybe you grew up with a milder narcissist and they don't have elements of sadism. Maybe they're more like a jerk and they're just self-absorbed and selfish, and so that advice wouldn't pertain to you. I think in that case, if you're not dealing with a pathological narcissist, then maybe you can just like kind of get away from them and establish boundaries, and they're not going to be as scary as the other ones who are trying to control and subjugate you and kind of elicit negative emotions from you all the time. So I'm going to talk about the following books, and these books mention an aspect of narcissism, like the mild version, or they superficially go over it, and they kind of omit other parts, which is like extreme narcissist, malignant narcissist, pathological narcissist. If these are the only books I read about the disorder, I'd be highly misinformed, because some of the advice is harmful for those dealing with a malignant narcissist. And the author defines the narcissist to be a selfish and self-centered, self-absorbed person, so I think they're using the word narcissist wrong. Because the DSM has criteria on what a narcissist is, and it's just more than what a jerk is. And Daniel Shaw would say that a pathological narcissist has a sinister power and control dynamic, and you have to be inferior. And there's way more relational harm. And a lot of these books don't address that. For example, Rethinking Narcissism by Craig Malkin, and he has an MD. His book defined narcissism as an addiction to feeling special, which in my opinion is an incomplete definition because he mistakes jerks for narcissists, people who have traits of self-absorption and selfishness, but who are capable of self-reflection and change. And so throughout his whole book, in this one, his definition omits malignant narcissist, or what Daniel Shaw calls the traumatizing narcissist, in which the abuser is intentional and aware of his abuse of another loved one, and they get a power trip from it because they have zero emotional empathy. So the one takeaway I got from Malkin's book is that narcissism is on a spectrum, and for some reason he only talks about the lower level ones on the spectrum and not the scary malignant ones. There is no discussion of that in the book at all. And there are some people who have traits of and who are not full blown. And he constructs a spectrum where it's like 0 to 10. And so 0 would indicate a person with no boundaries and self-esteem. So 5 would be a person with self-worth who has healthy narcissism. And 10 would be like a pathological narcissist. So I guess if you're a 6, that means you're healthy, you can give and take, and you have a few traits of selfishness and self-absorption, but you're capable of reflection and change. I kind of like the concept, but I really dislike the name healthy narcissism because I think it's misleading. I would just call a healthy person who is able to give and receive help. Narcissism has nothing to do with it. Narcissism, in my opinion, would be a distinct pathology. It would be a cluster B pathology when someone is extremely exploitative. They have a grandiose self. They're detached from reality. I don't know if anything about that is healthy. I think a person needs to develop self-love and self-compassion, and healthy narcissism is just kind of just confusing and misleading. Malkin states that the causes are genetic and environmental, meaning parents who don't properly nurture their children can raise narcissists. He states that people can recognize narcissists from the following signs, like emotion phobia, being afraid of other people's emotions, projection, control, idealization, or love bombing. There are better books at explaining the causes and signs of narcissism, and this book will not help anyone who is dealing with a pathological narcissist. His book title is misleading and should be relabeled Rethinking Jerks and should omit narcissism from the title. His advice for dealing with narcissists is harmful. For example, he states that if narcissists are approached in a gentler way, many may seem to soften emotionally. When they feel secure love, they become more loving and committed in return. So here, his advice is not good for narcissists. It's okay for jerks who are capable of self-reflection. And if you apply that advice to a narcissist, they will still abuse you. There's nothing you can do because their goal is to control and dominate and deny your human rights for separateness by always invalidating your emotions, denying your needs, putting down opinions, and not listening to your perceptions of reality because they are the only ones that can dictate what is true. If you are gentle about providing feedback, the pathological narcissist would still be offended. And how dare you give feedback? Don't you know that you're an inferior peon and they'll attack you because they are perfect and they don't want to show any vulnerability? And they're incapable of attachment and love. 26. Why Is It Always About You? By Sandy Hotchkiss. Hotchkiss explains the 7 deadly sins of narcissism, like a lack of shame, magical thinking, arrogance, envy, entitlement, exploitation, and bad boundaries. The strategies to survive are to know you, embrace reality, set boundaries, and cultivate reciprocal relationships. The presentation about narcissism is all right, and I disagree with her advice and coping, like when she says you need to deliver your message in a gentler way or set boundaries. Like again, this advice is useful for jerks. It's horrible for dealing with malignant narcissists. Like, if you try any of this, if you do confrontation, if you do gentle confrontation, if you're just really nice, they still hate you. They just want to attack you and they see you as inferior. You're always wrong. You're a tool to be used and they're always perfect. So you can't give any feedback in a nice way or a mean way. It doesn't matter. However, I liked how she said that we can prevent narcissism by becoming better parents. And a lot of them do say that. And I think a lot of it is environmental. 27. Disarming the Narcissist by Wendy T. Beharry. And I think she's a psychotherapist, counselor or something. I think some of the techniques in this book is, again, useful for dealing with jerks or difficult people. But this book is really harmful for those dealing with a malignant or pathological narcissist. Her tools of using empathetic confrontation and other ways to manage a narcissist deny the reality of the situation. Look, the narcissist is trying to use you. They don't care about your needs. They're trying to subjugate you. And some of them are sadistic. They're the malignant types. And she fails to acknowledge that there's the malignant types when, like, Daniel Shaw, Otto Kernberg, and other psychologists highlight this aspect of sadistic narcissism. The title is misleading because the latter part says thriving, and nobody can thrive with a narcissist. So if she titled her book Disarming the Jerk, it would be more accurate. So I think authors like Malkin and Beharry are diluting the word narcissist to mean jerks. And they're an example of why YouTube survivors are becoming really popular, because they're actually helping victims get out of an extremely toxic situation, because they're describing pathological narcissists when there's therapists who write books on narcissism, and it's like they're hopefully omitting this type of narcissist. These therapists who write on narcissism, these are an examples of the ones who don't get it, and their advice is harmful for victims. Therapist Joseph Burgo, in his book The Narcissist You Know, even writes about Wendy Beharry. While much of her advice is useful, why would you want to remain in a relationship where your survival depends on viewing your ostensibly adult partner as a child so beset by fear and shame he can't be reciprocal of your concern? You might be able to limit his more destructive behaviors, but what is the emotional reward? Despite your best efforts, he will remain largely incapable of true love and empathy. And so this other therapist is critical of her position and says that, look, the narcissist has no love and attachment. Why are you telling victims to stay in relationships or make it work or have empathetic confrontation? 28. Unmasking Narcissism, A Guide to Understanding the Narcissist in Your Life by Mark Edison, PsyD. I think this book should be retitled Unmasking the Jerk, because this is another author that doesn't talk about the extreme aspects of malignant narcissists. And so I think they kind of talk about the superficial layer. And so some of his advice is okay for dealing with difficult people or jerks, but there's better books on narcissism out there. And the same thing with the next book, The Everything Guide to Narcissistic Personality Disorder by Cynthia Lee Chen Goodman. It's another example of a book written by a therapist who understands narcissism in a very superficial way and not fully. So going back to psychopathy, 30. Almost a Psychopath by Ronald Shulton. The author describes psychopathy as a major abnormality in how people interact with the world and around them, characterized by a lack of empathy for other people's feelings and behaviors that are considered inappropriately deceitful, aggressive, and indifferent to the rights and feelings of others. Psychopaths do not have a fear response experienced by the most of us, and they engage in criminal or risky behavior, and they're relatively insensitive to punishment. They rely on instrumental aggression, and psychopaths often learn to express remorse if they're successful, and they find it the best way to get out of trouble, and this remorse is superficial and temporary. So a lot of like psychopaths and narcissists will say, oh, I'm so sorry, and pretend to be sorry, but they're not. And they know it's because they're mimicking human behavior. They look at us, they watch TV, and then they practice facial expressions in the mirror. And I saw my brother do that. The differing aspect is that for this book, he introduces a spectrum concept of psychopathy. So psychopathy isn't black and white. So people read the diagnostic statistical manual and think of antisocial, and they see a bunch of criminal elements and they're like, oh, my predator isn't like that. But Remember, from Dr. Martha Stout, psychopaths are all different. They have different needs and values, and they look different. And so it's important to establish if the person has emotional empathy, because some predators are violent, others are not. Some are just emotionally abusive. And I think Shulton provides different examples of psychopaths. Like, he gives 10 key indicators, like they're charming, they lack emotional empathy, they pursue self-interest, devoid of moral obligation to others, pathological lying, conning, always externalizing blame, no true remorse, limited capacity to experience and express feelings of others or maintain a relationship, easy to ignore responsibilities, and making others exist solely to gratify their needs and wants. 31. Confessions of a Sociopath by M.E. Thomas. For this book, a female psychopath or sociopath got diagnosed by a university researcher, and she wrote a first-person account of her life and inner thought process. I can't confirm 100% if she's a sociopath, because it's self-reported. However, it is an interesting read where a sociopath rationalizes and minimizes her intentional bad behavior and direct harm for others, feels no remorse about it, and then proceeds to see herself as a victim, even though she's an abuser, and she's super arrogant about it all. I did a book review on this, and it was interesting, and it reminded me of the videos I made about the malignant narcissist, morality, and moral reasoning. Overall, it's an interesting read of a mindset of a predator. Now, I'm going to review two books, in my opinion, that spread misinformation on psychopathy. I was pretty disturbed about this, as victims already have a hard time with society denying the existence of what real psychopaths are. They're your neighbor, your mother, your coworker, your friend, they blend in. And these books make it harder because they frame the disorder in an inaccurate and trivial manner, and they do a huge disservice to the public because people will not be prepared to deal with this type of predator if they actually do become a target. When people get screwed over by a psychopath in business, work, friendship, or relationship, they may not understand what happens unless they read a book from experts in the field who actually get narcissism right and talk about pathological ones, or they may encounter a victim who has been personally victimized by a narcissist and psychopath, and they have accepted the brutal truth about the existence of these types of people. 32. The Psychopath Test: A Journey into the Madness Industry by John Ronson, and he's a journalist. And he interviewed Dr. Robert Hare and other psychopaths and created his own test for psychopathy based on a few isolated cases, and it ends up being shallow and misleading. This is a highly popular book, and the author even has a TED Talk, which is highly unfortunate because even after studying psychopathy for some time, Ronson still doesn't get it. He treats psychopathy with frivolousness, and that's because he took a very cursory and superficial investigation that led to very limited understanding of this condition. He claims that he is an adept psychopath spotter. And that's not true, because even trained experts have a hard time spotting them, because some psychopaths are extremely high-functioning, and they're able to mimic emotional empathy by studying us for years. Predators don't have emotional empathy, but they can pretend pretty well. Psychopathy is not madness, as he states in the title. Psychopaths are not crazy. They know what they're doing is wrong, and they just don't care. They just have moral insanity, meaning they don't have emotional empathy, so they don't have the same innate morality of reciprocity and care that mammals do. And so some of the things that they do can come off as insane, because people who have empathy would never do that. I agree with Dr. Hare, who states that Ronson's investigation of psychopathy is deeply misleading, and his book is full of incorrect statements. It's sad because Ronson had a popular platform to spread awareness, and it ended up spreading misinformation. Victims are already gaslighted by society's denial and existence of malignant predators. Ronson probably never personally suffered at the hands of a psychopath, and his journalistic research in this case is superficial and cursory, and he drew incorrect conclusions. The next book, Wisdom a Psychopath, by Kevin Dutton. And this author claims that some traits of psychopathy are beneficial, and we need some elements of psychopathy within us. And Using emotional empathy for decision-making isn't always the best policy. So in this book, he misuses language, and his book increases misconceptions. Psychopathy is not a pick-and-choose trait. It's when you don't have emotional empathy, followed by other negative characteristics in the DSM manual. What Dutton is trying to say is that some people have negative traits, and that's okay, because we're human, and we have vices like greed and gluttony and selfishness, and so we behave badly. And that's part of being a human being, because humans are complex, with complex motivations and emotions and behaviors, and we have different values and interests. And there is a dark side of human nature. As humans, we are capable of helping others and harming others. And when humans behave badly, that doesn't mean they're a psychopath. What's worse is that Dutton is describing a positive association with psychopathy, which has no known cure, and is highly toxic and poses a net negative on society when these creatures ruin lives with no remorse. Psychopaths like risk-taking, and he says that risk-taking is a good trait, but being a risk-taker doesn't mean you are a psychopath, and that's where he's using faulty logic. Someone can have a trait of risk-taking without having psychopathy. And the author fails to separate that. Overall, his book spreads misinformation. Some of the working conclusions that I came to based on these books and YouTube videos and personal experiences are the following. 1. Narcissism is a spectrum disorder, meaning someone can have traits of, but not be pathological, meaning they are capable of self-reflection and they tend to be more selfish and self-absorbed takers, but these individuals may be able to change. And I guess they would be called jerks or extremely mild narcissists, and that's what a lot of therapists write about. And a lot of them don't talk about the extreme pathological ones that are sadistic, intentional, have a degree of awareness when they're harming you, and they don't care. So that would be the extreme end. And there's a lot at the extreme end, and that's why there's so many YouTube videos about them. Several authors agree with this continuum concept. 2. A combination of genetic predisposition and environmental factors, such as childhood neglect or abuse, or maybe excessive overspoiling, can lead to cluster B personalities. I don't think it's true that narcissists went through more childhood abuse than other codependents or victims, because a lot of victims went through the most horrendous child abuse and they don't abuse others. It's not necessarily true that narcissists can't help it and they don't mean it and they're a tortured soul. That's not definitively true. People are just saying that because they're projecting their internal infrastructure onto the narcissist when the narcissist is completely different. They're a predator, they're not like you, they don't feel remorse. There is a degree of free will and choice, so it's not like they just can't completely help it. They make choices in who to select as targets and who to abuse and when to abuse, whether it's public or in private, and how to abuse. And to do it over and over over time, every single day. Narcissists do have a degree of choice and awareness, and a lot of them like to hurt you, so there is an element of sadism. 3. I think some therapists who study narcissism understand it in a very superficial and cursory manner that is very incomplete, because maybe they didn't suffer at the hands of a pathological narcissist, so they don't get it, but then they have like a degree and they still write a book on it, and then they treat victims and they end up harming them because they think that they can help the victims, and they label the narcissist as a jerk, and they're like, hey, you can work with this jerk and have boundaries and just use empathetic confrontation. And that doesn't work with malignant narcissists. The victim will just be repeatedly emotionally abused and battered and set up for no-win scenarios, and they're going to be a smear campaign, and it's really dangerous for the victim to just keep interacting with a highly dangerous person. That is one reason why the online community for narcissism has exploded, because the majority of therapists out there don't understand NPD fully, and then the therapists who are writing books on it, not all of them, but some of them, don't even get this. They're failing to acknowledge it. It's kind of like they're just saying, hey, if the narcissists are in a spectrum, they're only talking about the mild ones. And I was like, no, there is a whole nother category. They're malignant, they're scary, and they're ruining lives. And they're not talking about those. It's like those therapists are pretending those narcissists don't exist or something. That's very strange. 4. Moreover, what happens is that some people may have suffered through a milder narcissist, and then they may create content, like writing blogs, YouTube videos, and more, and then they draw an overgeneralization to all narcissists based on their personal experiences. So their analysis doesn't include the reality and scary tactics of the extreme and malignant ones. And so their analysis may be incomplete, and their advice may not apply to your situation, because there is a variety of narcissists and predators, and there's a continuum of pathology and different manifestations of their manipulative behavior. So there's covert narcissists, there's overt, there's a spectrum for psychopathy, there's a spectrum for narcissism. 5. Narcissists have a degree of awareness and intentionally. There's a lot of apologists for narcissists, and maybe they're just trying to get you to feel sorry for predators. And that worked for me in the past, where I did think that they were a tortured soul. And I was wrong, because I don't think they're like me. In fact, the more I interact with my mom and my brother and my dad, they don't feel the same emotional spectrum that I do. And I don't feel like they're tortured. In fact, I see their smirk, and I think they feel elated every time they fucked with somebody. And so that's not right for me to project my human experience on them. I can't say that they're tortured souls, but what I can say for sure is that they pretend to be tortured souls. They continually feel butthurt and victimized when they're not getting their way. They use instrumental emotion, like they feel very rageful and upset if they don't get their way, and then they go quickly back to equilibrium, which makes me think that it's extremely manipulative and they really don't feel those emotions. Or if they do, it's in a very superficial way, so it's not like me, because they don't feel remorse like me. Pathological narcissists are very dangerous and cannot be reformed, unfortunately. There's no cure. There's no cure for psychopathy. There's no known cure for malignant narcissism at this point. 6. Predators, or cluster Bs, are about 7 to 12% or more of the population, and they're probably responsible for the majority of human suffering and exploitation, manipulation, and power tripping on an interpersonal, societal, and global level through relationships and leadership positions in organizations and industries. Overall, the ideas and evidence matter the most, and when I'm reading these books, sometimes the credentials matter, and that's an indicator that the author has some education and training, and it's a proxy for competency, but it doesn't guarantee expertise in personality disorders, narcissism, cluster B, because the undergraduate and graduate courses and clinical training in psychology is not only based on an incorrect assumption of human nature, but a lot of the details about personality disorders are omitted. Just look up any university core requirement program and confirm for yourself. People who are experts in personality disorders have studied the subject matter in a deeper level and have chose to listen to their victims and may have been a target of abuse, and they go above and beyond to acquaint themselves with this niche topic in psychology. So for the books that were useful, like Betrayal Bonds, I'm very grateful for the psychologists who do really understand this personality disorder. People who wrote like Coercive Control and more. Moreover, I was able to extricate myself from abusive relationships because I binge watched YouTube videos and listened to different victims' experiences. They told the truth. They were no bullshit. They were able to call out evil for what it was. And a lot of victims have deep experiential knowledge of the tactics that narcissists use that most psychologists don't talk about because they haven't personally suffered through a narcissist. Although I have a high respect for academia and research, the psychological field as a whole is doing a poor job in comparison to real victims who are sharing their stories in helping abuse survivors. There is a distinction between never having been a target of a cluster B and then being a target of a cluster B who has deep experiential understanding of it. The victims are able to detail, like, the procedural steps of a smear campaign, or how the narcissist conditions you to sabotage yourself, how they install an inner critic, and all these other sadistic things that the narcissist intentionally does to make sure that you feel emotional pain. So I'm grateful for the authors that I mentioned that do a good job in describing the pathological malignant narcissist, because I think those books, in conjunction with binge watching YouTube videos, help me a lot. Thank you for watching the Growth After Abuse YouTube channel. If you enjoyed this video, please share it with other people. Take care, guys.